Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the state visit of President Trump to the UK and his furious tweeting of insults at the Mayor of London and CNN before lunch and a banquet with the royal family at Buckingham Palace, which appeared to be a Trump family outing with his four children minus the youngest in attendance. Notably absent from the dinner was Prince Harry and the Queen's granddaughter-in-law, Meghan Markle, who Trump insulted in a recent interview with Murdoch's Sun newspaper, calling her nasty, which he later denied even though Trump is on tape saying it. One of the world's leading analysts of popular culture and media, Toby Miller, a professor of media and creative industries at Loughborough University in London, joins us to discuss how Trump has complicated matters for his British hosts by meddling in British politics in praising the Brexiteer Nigel Farage as his favourite member of parliament, even though Farage is not a member of the British Parliament, and promoting Boris Johnson as his choice to succeed outgoing British Prime Minister Theresa May. Protesters set up a giant screen on Big Ben next to Parliament House and projected a video of Boris Johnson criticising Trump as unfit for office. But the main protests are scheduled for tomorrow, with over 250,000 Londoners expected to voice their disapproval of the American president. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, who will address the crowd, tweeted, quote, "Stand in solidarity with those Trump has attacked in America, around the world, and in our own country, including just this morning, Mayor Sadiq Khan." Then we will speak with Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, who is the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. He joins us to discuss the constitutional crisis a lawless president has provoked and the need for the House Democrats to proceed with impeachment and follow the constitutional remedy Robert Mueller referred to in impenetrable legalese in his recent brief and painfully oblique final 10-minute address to the media. Then finally, we'll examine the major investigative article in Monday's New York Times outlining the alarmingly inappropriate conflicts of interest Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao brings to her job of overseeing shipping, since her family's shipping business has such close ties to top Chinese leaders. And as it happens, she is married to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has received generous campaign donations from the Chao family. Kathleen Clark, professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis, who works in the areas of legal ethics, the law of whistleblowing, and national security law, joins us to discuss the swampiness of Trump's cabinet. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. Again, joining us now is Toby Miller, a professor of media and creative industries at Loughborough University in London, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities, and his latest book is Greenwashing Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
It's nice to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you. And the President of the United States, of course, is in the UK. He spent the day with the royals ending up with a banquet at Buckingham Palace, at which the Labour leader refused to attend. There were demonstrators outside of Buckingham Palace, some supporting Trump, many not. Of course, the big blimp of the baby Trump is floating around, dogging him. And he's managed to tweet out insults to the Mayor of London prior to arriving in the UK. In an interview with Murdoch's The Sun, he mentioned that Meghan Markle, the Queen's granddaughter-in-law, is a nasty person, or said she was nasty. And then, of course, he turned around and pretended he didn't say that, although it's on the record. How does this strike you? I mean, I'm astounded that the royals are giving this guy the full Monty.
Well, I think in part it's, in a sense, required in the job description, in that he's a head of state of a country that is a long-standing ally in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, and the United States and Britain are friendly nations. And the Queen, who, of course, never really had any proper schooling or any kind of education, like most members of a so-called royal family, is also a head of state. And so part of her requirements in her position is to welcome other heads of state. Now, of course, the big difference between her and Trump is that, however undeserving she may be of her position, she does know how to keep her opinions to herself and not insult others. So in my opinion, even though this is a constitutional arrangement, it is appalling in the context of what he's said about the Mayor of London, Mayor Khan, and it's astonishing in terms of what he's said about the Queen's granddaughter-in-law, Meghan Markle. But of course, the other element to it, there are really a couple of other elements. One is the so-called special relationship, and the other is the Second World War. So the special relationship, which is an expression that I think barely signifies in the United States, is something that the British from all sides of politics, maybe less Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party's leader whom you mentioned a moment ago, people from all sides of politics, though, like to refer to. They imagine from Britain's side that the US admires the British, loves them, makes special concessions for them, and will always be our strongest ally. As I said, this means almost nothing in the United States, but it means a lot there, even when someone as venal as Trump is involved. And secondly, there's the war, because this is, of course, in part about acknowledging, I'm not sure celebrating is the right word, the horrendous loss of life of Americans, Britons, and others in the Normandy landings in 1944 in the war against fascism. And part of a special relationship and part of celebrating the war is managing to exclude Russia, Ukraine, and other places that once formed the Soviet Union from the grand narrative of the Second World War and the fight against fascism, ultimately successful, in order then to be the justification for all the military adventurism that Britain and the US have engaged in the 70 or 80 years since.
And of course, this trip of Trump's will end at Normandy on the anniversary of D-Day. So who then set up this state visit, though? Was it, if the Queen is doing her duty as head of state, was this set up by May, by Prime Minister May, who, by the way, is a lame duck? He's already met with her. And, of course, that's not, that's kind of pointless. He's insulted her. At the same time, praised her opponent, Nigel Farage, who's not even a member of the British Parliament, although he, Trump says he talked about him as if he was. And, of course, he endorsed Boris Johnson as Theresa May's successor.
Well, this is the other point about the invitation being quite inappropriate given his conduct in this extraordinary interference in British domestic politics. The invitation came as a consequence of the British government, which is the Conservative or Tory party, currently led by Theresa May, who is also the Prime Minister. Though, as you said, she's given notice of her resignation in a few days, and her successor will be selected not by popular vote across the country, not by the Parliamentary Conservative Party in the House of Commons, which is like the House of Representatives, but rather by the 120,000 or so strong members of the Conservative Party, like registered voters, if you like, across the country, from a shortlist of two that will be drawn up by the Parliamentary Party. And the person that Trump favors in that, who may, of course, or may not be in the final shortlist, is this appalling person, Boris Johnson, also a former mayor of London, who years ago in that job, only 4 years ago, actually insulted Trump repeatedly, but now is his best friend. And it's been suggested not only that should Johnson prevail, that would be a good thing in Trump's eyes, but also that Nigel Farage, who is a member of an opposing political party, the what used to be the UKIP party that he ran, now he runs the Brexit party, should handle Britain's departure from the European Union. Farage has never been elected in Britain. He's been completely unsuccessful in his candidacy there. He has been successful in getting elected to the European Parliament. where, of course, he is the subject of numerous financial inquiries about misuse of funds, quite apart from his appalling attendance, voting, and participation record. So, as usual, Trump is making bad decisions and taking them in a bad way.
And again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who's a professor of media and creative industries at Loughborough University in London, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities, and his latest book is Greenwashing Culture. So, of course, you just mentioned Boris Johnson, who Trump plugged to be the next prime minister. There's a video of Boris Johnson calling Trump unfit for office. Apparently it was projected on Big Ben next to the Parliament upon Trump's arrival by a group of anti-Brexit activists. We can only guess whether Trump noticed that. But I guess, you know, it's so clear that if you praise Trump, and this is the world leaders have to know about this, they have to exploit this. If you praise him and flatter him, he'll give you anything. And if you criticize him, he'll say the most nasty things about you. So somehow Johnson has been forgiven. I don't quite know what happened there. Do you?
Johnson changed his position. So in the last 18 months, he's been saying extremely positive things about Trump. I guess one way of thinking about this is to see that if you take Barack Obama and contrast him with Trump, and one can't think of a greater contrast in so many ways, one of the things that Obama had about him, regardless of his appalling policies in a number of areas, everything from imperialist behavior to domestic failure, he had dignity. And he also managed much of the time to take politics in a sense off the back page, or off the front page, rather, by which I mean that I imagine there may come a time when Americans decide that they want to be able to turn safely to the sports pages, or even have sports pages dominating the front page of the virtual paper, rather than always have to worry about a man saying and doing appalling things and looking and acting like a buffoon. Whatever else Obama may have been, he wasn't that. And that element of dignity is something that Boris Johnson doesn't have. Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London now, does. Farage does not. Trump does not. I mean, none of the populists do. And who knows how long it will take for the people of the country in these different parts of the world to say, actually, one of the elements we want in a head of state or a mayor or a diplomat is the ability to behave in a temperate, thoughtful, and kindly way. And one of the things that's sad about the populist surge that we're experiencing in so many parts of the so-called advanced industrial world is the lack of politeness and thoughtfulness, the basic absence of civility, and the extraordinary narcissism of these men. And they are, of course, mostly men.
Well, they're also criminally compromised. In the case of Trump, of course, it's just we could spend the next few hours talking about how much he's compromised, particularly by the Russians. But so is Farage. You know, the biggest donor to Brexit is this fellow Aaron Banks, who married a Russian prostitute who was kicked out of the Emirates. She was working for the Russian intelligence, the FSB. She was like literally a FSB hooker. She gets booted out of the Emirates, shows up in London, marries Aaron Banks, and lo and behold, £9 million is funneled through her by the Russians into the Brexit campaign. He's the biggest donor to Brexit. And the rest is history. You've got to admit, for a very small investment, Putin has paralyzed the United Kingdom. They're engaged in zombie politics. They don't know how to get out from under Brexit. It's an amazing situation.
It is indeed. And it also shows, though, some of the fundamental weaknesses and failures of social democracy as practiced in Western Europe, especially in Britain, that if we think back to the time when social democrats were in power in the UK, so 1997 to 2010, first Tony Blair as Prime Minister and then Gordon Brown, they were abject failures at recognizing what to do about the white male working class in the context of the global capitalist expansion into all corners of life that they so welcomed. They wanted money from financiers. bankers and lawyers. They wanted to look like good guardians of the capitalist economy. They increasingly thought that they could win big urban centers and the middle class. Does this sound like the Democratic Party at all, Ian? And so as part of that, they really did not think very much about those who did not succeed, many of whom hold attitudes that the so-called liberal cosmopolitan urban intelligentsia, all those words are used in Britain just as they are in the United States, loved. And the EU was part of that. So it's not just that a lot of the people who voted for Brexit and continue support it were dupes as a consequence of, as you rightly say, appalling conduct by elements of the Russian government and people involved in UK politics. It's also that they really are people left behind and not cared for and not thought about. And they're in situations not dissimilar to many of the Obama voters in the upper Midwest who shifted allegiance in 2016. And it's still the case that no one in politics speaks adequately to their needs or seeks to find their needs out. So I think it is important on the one hand to acknowledge, as you say, that Farage and others like Trump are clearly implicated in malfeasance. But it's also right to say that the pro-Brexit people and the Social Democrats, when they were in power in Britain, the Labour Party, just like when the Democrats were in power in the US, simply failed to reach out and acknowledge the political economic circumstances of traditional working class white male bases to their power.
Well, I think another way to put it is that under Clinton, the Democrats decided the unions are being absolutely ground down in America. They used to be 30-40% of the workforce in the 1950s, and now they're down to about 7%, and they don't have the money they used to have to support the Democratic Party. So they turn to Wall Street. So you have a situation in the United States where the two major parties get their money from the same people. The Republicans, of course, are a natural fit with the plutocrats and the moneyed class, whereas the Democrats have to lie to their voters and pretend that they support them while taking their money from the same people that the Republicans get their money from. So, but when you talk about social democracy in the UK failing in the form of the Labour centrist like Tony Blair, it's happened also in Germany. The Social Democratic Party is almost extinct in Germany, and in France it's almost extinct, and in Italy it's almost extinct. So something has happened on a broad scale, surely, to these traditional centre-left parties.
Well, I think that's right, although there are exceptions. For example, the socialists, as they're called in Spain, have come back very strongly, having lost a lot of votes to the right, but also to the further left in the shape of Podemos. Despite the headlines around the world about triumphs for the populist anti-immigrant right in Sweden, in fact, the Social Democrats did quite well. In Britain, which has the largest mass base of members of the social democratic left of any party in Europe, there has been a successful return, not to power, but to significant numbers of members of parliament in the 2017 elections. So it's not a universal pattern, but it's there. And there are local elements to explain it. One of these is the appeal of nationalism, the Pied Piper element of nationalism as a riposte to the European cosmopolitanism that has been in many ways very successfully drawn upon by Germany and France, and lest anybody imagine otherwise. It is true that European Union is run by the French and the Germans. But to give you an example of how profound this is, let me take you, if I could, to my citizenship test to become a US person. So although I was born in Britain, I have a British passport, I am also a US citizen. And one of the questions that we were asked in the citizenship exam was, which three countries won the Second World War? So, Ian, here's my question to you for 10 points. Which three countries won the Second World War?
Well, I imagine the one that bore the brunt of the Second World War, the Soviet Union, was not a part of the three. But I would say the UK, the US, and the Soviet Union.
Well, you'd be right in terms of those who bore the brunt of the war, but you'd fail in your attempt to become a United States citizen. The answers were, and this was under Obama, a nation state that doesn't exist, England, the United States, and France, which last I saw was occupied for most of the war. And of course, the Soviet Union, but maybe 20 to 25 million died in the war against fascism, not part of it. So that kind of nationalism that is being celebrated as part of Trump's visit, which is why I went back to the story, is such an important legitimating factor in the way that both these countries and many parts of Europe think about the world. Those of us in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, might laugh roundly at the idea of Europe as the bastion of popular democracy, given so much of Western Europe's role in imperialism and colonialism. But it matters a lot, and the foundational myth of that is the war, even for Germany, because of the way in which there has been a sense of penance, of penitence paid by the Germans ever since, and which Chancellor Merkel is going to engage in, rightly so, at the celebration of the Normandy invasion. So I do think there's something there about nationalism and the Democratic Party and the Labour Party in Britain and their corollaries in other European nations have missed a trick on, and which the Republican Party is good at picking up on, and so are the Brexiteers, and so are those in other parts of Western Europe who would leave the European Union. Namely, we are special, we are different, we are this particular people, and we object to any attempt to push us into a globalizing or continental entity. That sovereignty, the word that's used a lot by Brexiteers, however absurd it may be, has actually rung bells with those who've been left behind by globalization.
Well, just in closing, to add to the list of the demise of social democracy and center-left parties, although you mentioned Spain as an example of the reverse, and frankly, what's happening here in the United States to the Democratic Party is also the reverse. The S word is no longer a dirty word, and we'll see what happens. Obviously, this is a very crowded field of candidates, but the energy seems to be on the left, and the defensiveness is on the right of the Democratic Party. But Australia just elected an equivalent of Mike Pence on the Conservative ticket, and Labor blew it. So what happened there?
You're absolutely right. To the extent that politics is presidential, I think the Labour Party has had a succession of really very poor candidates. Bill Shorten was the leader of the Australian Labour Party in the recently conducted election there, and he was about as charismatic as, wait for it, Al Gore, John Kerry, and Hillary Clinton put together. And whatever else Tiberius, currently trading as the 45th president of the United States, DJ Trump may be, he has a certain charisma, just as Bill Clinton did, just as Barack Obama did. Shorten didn't. And that's often been the problem with leaders, even in what are supposedly not presidential arenas. So one of the explanations for Jeremy Corbyn doing well in the 2017 British election was that he was charismatic, whereas Shorten just looked like he was out of central casting and reading a script in precisely the same way that befell Gore, Kerry, and Hillary Clinton.
And Dukakis and Mondale, and the list goes on.
And on it goes.
Yes. Well, I thank you for joining us. I think we digressed a little bit from the royals, but they have to suffer through Trump, and that's their punishment. So I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who's a professor of media and creative industries at Loughborough University in London, one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities, and his latest book is Greenwashing Culture. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with a call for the House Democrats to proceed with impeachment to follow the constitutional remedy Robert Mueller referred to in impenetrable legalese in his final 10-minute address.
London calling to the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Corey Brettschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writings appeared in Time, Politico, and The New York Times, and he is the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Brettschneider.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Well, thank you. And again, the Oracle spoke, Robert Mueller, last week, but he did so in such impenetrable legalese that it's, yes, has not had the kind of effect, particularly the one that the Democrats were hoping for, since William Barr has done such a great job of blunting the impact of the Mueller report itself by framing it in such a way to exonerate President Trump, when in fact the report does the opposite. I find it a supreme irony, Corey Brettschneider, that Mueller has been handcuffed by the infamous OLC opinion that a sitting president can't be indicted. The origins of that rule, that DOJ rule, go back to Kenneth Starr and the abuse of his impeachment of Clinton over a personal sexual dalliance that he was trying to keep from his wife. That is when they decided to come up with this rule so that the law couldn't be politicized again. And it's such an irony that a Republican partisan like Starr is responsible for something that another Republican partisan like Barr was able to exploit.
It goes back even before that. The first, there are two Office of Legal Counsel memos internal to the Department of Justice. The first is the Richard Nixon administration, Nixon's Office of Legal Counsel internal to the Department of Justice, wrote a memo saying that the president was essentially too dignified to be indicted, that the office of the presidency was too fundamental during Watergate, when, of course, they were worried about that. And then the second one, the second memo, is during the Clinton years, the Clinton OLC, also around the time of the Clinton impeachment, and also around the time that, as you say, that Ken Starr was looking into his wrongdoing, the internal department of the Office of Legal Counsel said that Ken Starr couldn't indict the president, could not. And what's interesting to me is that Ken Starr, the Republican, you know, basically, I guess he claimed to be nonpartisan, but certainly was associated with the Republican Party, with Kavanaugh working for him, they had a dueling memo that said that actually we can indict Bill Clinton, that we think that if he's not above the law and if he's guilty, that we can indict him. They, of course, decided not to, and to instead turn the information over for impeachment, and the House went ahead with impeachment. But, you know, you've got these two. I guess to me, I put the blame certainly on the Nixon administration's Office of Legal Counsel. But I also, frankly, put the blame on Clinton, because it was his internal Office of Legal Counsel, or at least the Clinton administration Office of Legal Counsel, that also reaffirmed the holding in Nixon. I mean, the bottom line to me, you know, to get to brass tacks, is this is not a Supreme Court ruling. It's not based in any Supreme Court case law, although it supposedly appeals to them. And yet it's being treated as if it is. And the constitutional text, the principles of the law, all suggest the opposite. So I had a piece very early on when I was worried that this was going to happen in the Washington Post called "Yes, You Can Indict a Sitting President," that makes the case that from the perspective of the Constitution, the president is not above the law, period. That's what U.S. v. Nixon was about. That was what Clinton v. Jones was about, by the way, when the Supreme Court rejected all of the administration's argument about why Clinton should be immune from a civil subpoena. So to me, it's just frankly ridiculous that Mueller relied on this, that this is seen as kind of constitutional law, when it's really just about two memos written by these various offices at a time when their presidents were potentially going to be indicted.
So it is
a travesty.
Well, but this is the puzzling part. If Mueller believed that Trump committed a crime, which he apparently did, at least on 10 occasions, he outlines the obstruction of justice.
Exactly.
And even if he can't indict him, why didn't he say that he committed a crime?
I have no idea. He's certainly not prohibited from that, and there's nothing in the policy that suggests that he could have done that. And frankly, I think he should have. In fact, if you listen to him between the lines, that's exactly what he's saying. I mean, he parses language so that it's very, very hard to figure out what he's talking about. But when he says, I would have exonerated the president if he, you know, merited exoneration, it's another way of saying, look, I think he's guilty of obstruction of justice. And certainly when you read those 10 instances of obstruction and you read the report and you see the only reason why they didn't make a recommendation are these, frankly, silly memos. That's really what he's saying, that the president did it, that he is guilty of obstruction. And why he couldn't draw that conclusion, I don't know. He's very fond of parsing language, of appearing at least to be extremely careful. So when he said in that statement that it's time for other processes to take place, why not use the constitutional term that's actually embedded in the Constitution, namely impeachment? I found it very frustrating, and I know there's a defense that he's being careful and wanting to look nonpartisan, but I worry that the result is that we just are never going to understand what he found, namely that the president committed a crime.
Right, and Mueller did refer to the Constitution in oblique terms, hinting at impeachment, but not specifying.
Right. He used this phrase, other processes to begin.
Right.
And I feel like other processes, there's one process that's outlined in the Constitution, and that's impeachment. And more than that, you know, it is true that at the founding, I mean, to me, the reasons to support the idea that, yes, you can indict a sitting president are U.S. v. Nixon, the idea that a president is not above the law, the simple structure of our society that we don't think that offices confer immunity, that it places some people higher than others. But also there's at the founding, there's just a debate that goes on. And so James Wilson says basically what U.S. v. Nixon says, that nobody's above another. And so indictment is possible. But if you look at the alternative side, so granted all that, Alexander Hamilton is the most famous and important defender of the idea of immunity. And what he said was, OK, we need to have immunity so that we can have impeachment immediately and then try the president. But his whole point was that you've got to do impeachment if you're going to have the immunity. So unfortunately, we're undermining, you know, there's no principled basis for what looks like is happening, namely that we won't have an indictment, we won't have an impeachment, and he'll get away with it. By the way, the statute of limitations on obstruction of justice is 5 years. So that means that if the president is not impeached in the near term, he will never be tried. He'll get away with it. Despite Mr. Mueller saying we're trying to preserve the record for the future, that's going to turn out to be meaningless because the statute of limitations will have expired.
And again, I'm speaking with Corey Bretschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writings appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he is the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Well, the one part of Mueller's 10-minute remark after a couple of years of working on this report and having it misrepresented by Barr, who essentially sort of, I guess in football terms, he intercepted the ball and scored a touchdown, that Mueller was really clear, though, about one thing. In spite of all of the gobbledygook and this kind of constipated legalese, he did make it clear at the beginning of his remarks that Russia did attack this country through meddling in our elections. And he circled back at the end of his remarks saying that, again, Russia did attack us and every American should be concerned about that. Well, there is one American who's not concerned about it, and he happens to sit in the Oval Office. So how do we proceed? And this is the most surreal situation imaginable, where we have the President of the United States, in fact, covering up for Vladimir Putin. What's going on?
Yes. I mean, I want to not lose sight of the first really important thing that you said, which is that you were being polite about it and careful that Barr misrepresented the memo. To me, I mean, I try to be careful as well, but I don't see there's any other way to see it except that he lied. He got up there and seemingly deliberately misled the American public when he said that Mr. Mueller did not rely on the memo saying that a sitting president is immune. So, you know, when the Attorney General of the United States, who's tasked with carrying out the law, so blatantly misrepresents what's in the most important report of maybe our lifetimes, That suggests that, you know, we really are in a constitutional crisis, that the president and his chief law enforcement officer have essentially abandoned the rule of law. So what do we do? I mean, to me, this report has to immediately, for the reasons I was saying about Hamilton, go to the House. Nancy Pelosi has to stop playing it careful. And this person has to be, the president of the United States has to be subject to the beginning of an impeachment inquiry. And if the criminal justice process isn't going to happen, then that process has to happen. And the other person, I think, who really needs to have hearings about what he's done is the attorney general, who, as you said, misrepresented to the American public the most basic facts of the report. We know that from the report, and we know that from Mr. Mueller's statement.
So are we naive in thinking that this great constitution we have does protect us from what is actually happening at the moment? I mean, you literally have a president who has been placed above the law by his attorney general, who was acting as his personal lawyer. And now this same president is encouraging the breaking of the law in terms of not allowing his cabinet members to respond to lawful subpoenas, particularly in the case of the Secretary of the Treasury. The law is really clear in terms of handing over Trump's tax returns to the head of the House and Ways and Means Committee, but Mnuchin is falling on his sword to protect Trump, it's obvious. So we're told by the punditry that the reason that President Trump is behaving in this lawless manner is he's trying to goad the Democrats into impeaching him. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but the facts remain that we have a president who the attorney general has placed above the law who is now being lawless. That's extraordinary.
Yes. The way I put it in the book is to say, basically, there is no constitution police. There's no guarantee that the Constitution or our basic law or basic criminal law will be enforced. Instead, what the Constitution does do, though, is to give us mechanisms that people who care about the rule of law, who care about these ideals, can use. Now, ideally, courts would be involved in that. But in this instance, because Mr. Mueller, in citing this policy that kept him from indicting the president, passed the ball to Mr. Barr, I think he might have sincerely believed that Barr had the ability to override the memos and might have indicted. We know, of course, that's not going to happen. So there is a tool that has to be used, but it has to be used by principled people who are going to act on it, and that's impeachment. Now, the problem is that there is this strategy question, and I understand, I'm not naive, I understand Nancy Pelosi's worry, which is that, you know, the president will gain power in the election, will gain momentum if the Democrats impeach. But my response to that is, first of all, nobody knows the outcome of the election, and nobody knows how, if at all, positive or negative, an impeachment inquiry will play. Yes, they have internal polling, but you can't be confident about that. People can't predict the future. And so given the lack of certainty, there is a duty to be done, a constitutional duty. And in the same way that we think that the Republicans have basically lost that duty, have abandoned it by caring about their own reelection, their own strategy, it would be a tragedy if the Democrats do the same, that they abandon their constitutional duty because they are worried about this election. And I think you have to do it, period. That's what the Constitution demands if there's immunity. And Hamilton laid that out in that quote that I was talking about. If we're not going to indict, we're not going to have a criminal justice process, there's no choice but to pursue impeachment. Now, he was talking about regardless of party. I think that he didn't care if one was a Federalist or Democratic, Republican, or who they were affiliated with, but it was meant to be a constitutional duty beyond party. Now, this is, you know, members of the opposition party surely have to recognize that they can and need to do their constitutional duty. It's not a question of strategy. It's a question of guaranteeing that these mechanisms function. And if we don't use impeachment now, think about the future. When will we ever be able to use impeachment in the future? What would be the cause that would be worthy of it, if not this, where the president's own attorney general's office, the Office of Legal Counsel, is within the Department of Justice, within the attorney general's office, is saying that he basically committed a crime? I just can't imagine a more obvious instance where this has to be pursued. One last point about strategy. There weren't the votes either during Nixon in the Senate for impeachment until there were. And the way they got those votes is that these committees continued to look. They didn't worry about reelection. Nixon was reelected. But regardless of that, they went after him. And yes, eventually there were not the votes until there were. And then there were the votes. And they began impeachment inquiries. There was a vote in the House Judiciary Committee. And they were about to move to the full House and the Senate. And that's when the president resigned. But, you know, this is that scenario where they said, you know what, guys, let's just not do this whole impeachment thing because the president's too popular. What a tragedy that would have been if Nixon would have been left off the hook. And what my worry is that with this Democratic Party, they're flirting with that possibility of actually abandoning it. So if you're listening, you know, a lot of your listeners are in California, reach out to Nancy Pelosi's office and let them know you need to do your constitutional duty. That's my view on this.
Well, just in closing, on yesterday's program, David Rothkopf was suggesting that our reality TV president who came to power essentially with free media, who knows how to use reality TV and arguably his entire presidency is about government by stunt and by reality TV. He's always promising a cliffhanger and every day he throws some piece of chaos out there, what they call in the media the bright shining light for everybody to sort of seize on and get distracted by. That is going on, obviously. But Rothkopf made the point that what impeachment involves is public hearings, and that is reality TV. So he was making the argument that the president who rose to power because of reality TV could be brought down by reality TV. So therefore, the real challenge the Democrats have is once they get over this hand-wringing over to impeach or not to impeach and stop being Hamlet and start being congresspeople, the main point I think that David was making is they've got to schedule the reality TV in an effective way. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, emphatically. And in effect, if you think of the moments where the Democrats have done their duty and where they've actually gained traction, the Michael Cohen hearings were just dramatic to listen to this person testify in depth about, I don't know what you want to call it, the depravity of his former boss, his indifference to the rule of law, to principle. Americans need to hear that, otherwise they're not going to learn about it. And you know, Fox News will televise the hearings. They might have a spin afterwards, but at least their audience will see this. And the Democrats need to do that. Mr. Mueller says he doesn't want to testify. Too bad. The subpoena power of the House allows them to call him, and he can explain all of this stuff. He can try to parse words all he wants, but I would ask him some very specific questions. Is the president, in your opinion, if you were to issue a recommendation as a prosecutor, guilty of obstruction of justice or not? And I think his answer would be yes. Did the president, even if he didn't commit a crime when it comes to conspiracy with the Russians, is there a preponderance of the evidence or a substantial likelihood that he did collaborate with the Russian government? I think the answer probably would be yes, although I'm not sure. I'd like to hear the answer to that. Certainly, he flouted his duty. And remember, high crimes and misdemeanors don't have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The standard is very different. So the information and the kind of assessment that Mr. Mueller could give would be incredible. And not just him. We have a slew of characters who could testify about these issues. And, you know, once the evidence is out there, then the pressure on that the American people will bring on the not just the Democratic members, but the Republicans as well, especially the moderates, to impeach and then remove, I think would be substantial. And without hearings, I don't see how you get that pressure. So a long way of saying absolutely, I emphatically agree.
Well, Corey Bridgeschneider, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Pleasure as always.
Again, I've been speaking with Corey Bridgeschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writing has appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he's the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the major investigative article in Monday's New York Times outlining the alarmingly inappropriate conflicts of interest Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao brings to her job.
you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all the others waiting on a faraway shore.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kathleen Clark, who's a professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis, who works in the areas of legal ethics, government ethics, the law of whistleblowing, and national security law. And she's written for The New York Times, Washington Post, National Law Journal, Government Executive, and The Hill. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kathleen Clark.
Thank you.
And the New York Times' major revelations about Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Transportation's family, their ties to the highest levels of the Chinese government, and possible conflicts of interest being the Secretary of Transportation and her family owning a vast transportation company. This is beginning to make Wilbur Ross look like a small fry.
Well, I think that Secretary Chao is giving Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, a run for his money on who is the currently most corrupt member of the cabinet.
So I had...
Or I should say, you know, that's actually unfair to her. Who is the most conflicted, right? I think that's probably more accurate. I should be more precise.
Okay, I accept that for sure. But my only references to her so far have been in the context of the Boeing 737 MAX, in the sense that she has oversight over the FAA, and they clearly failed in not even testing this airplane, which could really do great damage to one of America's most successful export companies. But this report in the New York Times goes back in such depth that's just extraordinary. I had no idea, for example, that her Elaine Chao's father was a school friend of Jiang Zemin, who was a former Chinese leader. No, little wonder they have clout in China, and that they have better connections to the Chinese elite than most Americans, by the look of it.
Yes. They would be in the top, much less than 1% in terms of their connections to the Chinese government. I think that's accurate. And it reflects, I think, not just this past connection, but their continuing and current connections in terms of their sort of commercial and investment and donations in matters that the Chinese government cares a lot about.
So the article in the New York Times, of course, mentions Elaine Chao's husband, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader of the Senate, who, judging by what the article mentions in terms of how much money Elaine Chao's family and various of their associates have put into Mitch McConnell's political campaigns, one is left with the inescapable conclusion that Mitch McConnell married well. He's now one of the wealthiest members of the Senate. And believe you me, there are a lot of wealthy people in both the Senate and the House of Representatives.
Yes, I think it's accurate to say that in terms of the finances and no doubt otherwise, Mitch McConnell married well. And in terms of political connection, Ms. Chao married well.
So what does this say about this government in general? I mean, you study government corruption, the role of whistleblowers, the laws and ethics of government. What's your sense of where this particular government stands in an overall perspective of prior governments?
Oh, well, this administration is the most corrupt of my lifetime, and that includes Richard Nixon's administration. What we see on multiple fronts is politically appointed officials who are in a position to and seem to be using government office to enrich themselves, to help themselves and their family members. And so in that sense, Secretary Chao fits right in with the Trump administration. I would want to acknowledge that unlike some other members of the administration, she comes with sort of political and, I guess, professional credentials, having, you know, served in past Republican administrations. So she's in no way like a newcomer to government, unlike, say, Secretary of Education DeVos. But yeah, this administration sort of leaves us breathless trying to keep up with all of the political scandals and the corruption and you know, the various problems of maladministration. And so, yes, it's difficult to keep up with all of the bad news.
Well, of course, Elaine Chao probably could have had a choice of cabinet positions since she did serve in the Bush administration as Labor Secretary. But I think it's hardly a coincidence that she chose the Department of Transportation, since the Department of Transportation has oversight over U.S. shipping, and her family own a huge shipping line. So I don't know whether that was the reason, but the coincidence is certainly there.
Yes, and I'll just highlight one of the incidents that's mentioned in this sort of, well, deeply reported article in the New York Times. It involves Ms. Chao, I think, reaching out to embassy or U.S. consulate personnel in China, trying to arrange a visit, and including her family members in, or seeking to include her family members in government meetings. And so, which raises the possibility of, you know, sort of unfair treatment or unequal treatment. It's not entirely clear what happened. And of course, the trip was ended up being canceled. But the question is whether she was attempting to use these meetings with government officials, government-to-government meetings with the Chinese officials, in order to help her family's shipping company. So, yeah, the degree of insensitivity or just ignoring sort of ethics concerns and is really breathtaking.
Well, prior to this article in the New York Times, I had sort of assumed that the exemplar of using your government position to enrich your family and yourself, the prize had to go to Jared Kushner, who, even in the transition period in December of 2016, mm-hmm. he met with the Soviet ambassador Kislyak and the head of this Russian bank known as Putin Slush Fund. And ostensibly, he met to try and develop a back channel between the Trump administration and the Kremlin, which in itself is an alarming prospect in terms of national security. But apparently, and this is according to NSA intercepts of the reporting that went back from Ambassador Kislyak back to Moscow, they couldn't believe that at this meeting, Jared Kushner then turned to the head of the VNB Bank, this Russian bank that's known as Putin's slush fund, and asked for $500 million to bail out this building on 665 Fifth Avenue that he had that was underwater. And it's just amazing. And he's been doing this all along with the Saudis, his best friend, of course, being the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. We don't know how much money has changed hands. We do know that the Saudis made a $100 million gift to Ivanka Trump's foundation, which I'm not sure what charity that they're involved in. But this is, again, an extraordinary family business that has now found itself in a position to really enrich themselves as the head of the government of the United States.
Well, and one of the things that you're, one of the trends, I guess, or features that you're highlighting is reaching out to foreign officials, foreign governments for personal gain, which raises not just a sort of a standard conflict of interest concern, but actually the constitutional conflict of interest provision, the Foreign Emoluments Clause. There's been many stories about how it applies to President Trump, but it applies not just to President Trump, but to all, you know, high-level government officials. Also, with regard to Kushner, I want to just highlight another incident from way back when, I think during the transition, when his family was seeking financing, I believe, from Chinese officials, if you'll recall.
It's true. They went to the Chinese first, and then an insurance company. Yeah.
So you mentioned, did you see there was a Saudi $100 million contribution to a foundation run
by to Ivanka Trump.
By
yeah.
Ivanka?
No, yeah, absolutely. That happened early.
Oh, actually, I mean, and that happened during this administration or prior?
Mm-hmm. No, I think it happened either at the shortly before or after the inauguration. I'm not entirely sure. But it was definitely because, you know, the first foreign trip abroad they took was to Trump took was to Saudi Arabia.
Well, forgive me. I guess I somehow lost track of that. I didn't even recall that particular contribution. I'm going to look it up right now. So, yes, as you're pointing out the sort of the multitude of conflicts that basically have been embraced. You could like say this is a sort of a, not just a conflicted administration, but it's like they embrace the foreign conflicts of interest at the highest levels of this administration.
Right. Actually, I'm just told that the $100 million to Ivanka from the Saudis happened around May of 2017. And in fact, I've got this wrong, and I've got it wrong before. I have to correct it. According to the Wall Street Journal, the $100 million from the Saudis went to the World Bank Fund for Women Entrepreneurs that was the brainchild of Ivanka Trump. So let me point out an extraordinary contrast to what we're talking about this family business, the Trump family, all taking advantage of the position that they're in. And, of course, we heard from the testimony before the Congress from Michael Cohen that during the campaign, Trump kept saying, running for president is the greatest branding exercise for the Trump organization, mm-hmm. that he was just thrilled at how much money they were going to make out of promoting the brand running for president. And, of course, the irony is that he actually won, which I don't think was his intention. But just to put this into context, when you've got what looks like a team of grifters in the cabinet all aboard the Trump gravy train, today, as part of a reauthorization of the pipeline safety rules, Elaine Chao proposed an amendment that would give 20-year prison sentences to protesters who block the construction of crude or natural gas pipelines. So you recall, of course, the protests by the Native Americans against pipelines. And
Standing Rock.
Exactly. So this is happening across the country, and it's considered a legitimate political protest, particularly by people who are concerned about global warming or, in the case of the Native Americans, about having their sacred lands polluted. So I find that really deeply disgraceful, but also it gets to the heart of the matter, is that there are sort of, are we in two Americas, just in closing, Kathleen? An America for the super rich, the oligarchs, the plutocrats, and the America for the rest of us?
Well, it seems that we now have a government of the oligarchs, by the oligarchs, for the oligarchs. We'll have to see whether that is, that continues past 2020 in the next election. But the Trump administration, in addition to being corrupt, certainly has furthered the interests of the ultra wealthy. Against the health and other concerns of the people. So we'll see if the people are engaged enough in the next election to take back the government.
Well, Kathleen Clark, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with Kathleen Clark, who's a professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis, who works in the areas of legal ethics, government ethics, the law of whistleblowing, and national security law. And she's written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, The National Law Journal, Government Executive, and The Hill. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.